1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modesty, and discreetly, not with braided hair or in gold, no pearls, or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. The woman must quietly receive instructions with entire submissiveness. I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell in transgression. But women will be preserved through the bearing of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint.
Sermon notes, raise your hand, and one of the ushers will make sure you get one. Just an abbreviated version of what we'll be talking about this morning. Remember, Vacation Bible School starts in about 2 weeks. That's drawing near very quickly. I know the teachers and all their helpers are hard at work and doing all the stuff they need to be doing. But if you're not teaching or if you're not able to help or anything like that, that's fine because you can do a lot too by inviting others. Printed up some flyers that are now ready. They're in the foyer. I think some are in the literature rack. Some of them are on the table. So we've got plenty of those and we can print more. So please get one and try to invite others to our Vacation Bible School. Reggie mentioned the adult singles class. As he said, it's for college age and older. I've had several people ask if you've never been married, then you're an adult single. If you're widowed, you're an adult single. If you're divorced, you're an adult single. So it's open to you. We're just trying to talk to different groups within the congregation to make sure we're meeting your needs and understand the things that are important to you. And I know, as a preacher, I know probably a lot of the attention, and I know now as an elder, a lot of the attention that you give is really directed toward families, and that's just a necessary part of congregational life. But we forget sometimes about the adult singles, and we don't want to neglect your spiritual needs either. So if you're in that demographic group, you are certainly welcome to come, and we'd like to hear from you. And that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Some of you may remember a basketball player by the name of Hakeem Olajuwon. He played for the Houston Rockets in the NBA for quite a while. He went to college at the University of Houston. Remember the old Metro Conference, and I think Louisville used to be in that conference, so you probably saw him occasionally. He came to the United States from Nigeria, and he had never played basketball before arriving in Houston, Texas. He was a soccer player growing up, like many Nigerians are, but he quickly outgrew soccer when he reached about 7 feet tall. So he came to the United States, and he went down to Houston. He liked the weather in Houston, and he knew there was a good university there. He literally called the basketball coach and said, "Well, I'm from Nigeria, and I'd like to play basketball." And he actually went and sent somebody to pick him up. When he saw he was 7 feet tall, he figured he could use him. But anyway, he went on to be a very successful NBA player, a great college player, too. I saw an interview with him one time talking about his success early on in the NBA. And coming from Nigeria, he didn't have a lot when he came to this country. Life in Nigeria was pretty simple. And they asked him about some of the changes, and it took him through this house or apartment that he was living in. He had this monstrous closet. Of course, if you're 7 feet tall, wardrobe has to be vertically monstrous. But anyway, he had this monstrous closet just full of custom-made clothing. Of course, if you're 7 feet tall, that kind of goes along with it, too. But this one portion of his closet was just dedicated to suits. And I don't know how many suits he had. He was just kind of fingering through them, and just probably dozens of them. Of course, he could afford it, but the interviewer made the comment that apparently Olajuwon took very seriously the maxim that clothes nice clothes, if you buy stylish clothes, then people are going to look at you in a certain way, and they're going to like you in a certain way, and they'll treat you in a certain way. And many people very much live by that maxim. I want to challenge you to think, though, that it's not about you are what you wear, but rather, biblically speaking, I think you wear what you are. In other words, you wear what reflects your true character is really what the Bible teaches about clothing and the choices that we make about it. I want us to talk today about some principles about modesty and modest apparel. I think it's an important thing to talk about, and it's something that we try to talk about periodically. Whenever I talk about it, I learned about this very early on in preaching. No matter how I preach about it, somebody's going to be unhappy with me when I get done. For some people, I don't get specific enough. For some people, I get way too specific. For some people, I deal too much in principles and not enough in applications. For others, it's exactly the opposite. Some people agree with me and they love it, and some people disagree with me and they hate it. So, you know, whatever. At some point, you're just preaching and done with it. But I do think that concept, is it really that your clothes make you into what you are? Or is it really about what your clothes say about your character? And if I can get anything across in this lesson, I hope you get that. That idea, that very basic idea, that your clothing is a reflection of who and what you are, or at least who and what you're supposed to be. I want to begin just with that key thought. Very simply, your clothing reflects your character. That said, if you don't get anything else out of the lesson, get this, because that's what the Bible teaches more fundamentally than anything about clothing and character and the choices we make about what we wear. There's probably another way of stating it. It was on the title. You wear what you are, not the other way around. You wear things that reflect your inner nature. Now, I want to start in the first part of the lesson just by looking at some basic principles about modesty and clothing and the choices that we make. I want to start, first of all, with a simple statement, again, that clothing reflects your character. Now, we experience this a lot in just everyday life. If you're walking through a building, let's say you're in downtown Louisville, and you're walking through one of those big office buildings down there, you look up and see people walking all through those halls. And I've had the experience before. I'll be walking in an office building, and there might be two people side by side. One is a man dressed in a $1,500 suit, and he's got $300 shoes and a $200 tie and a $250 dress shirt. I would assume from his attire that most likely he's a business executive. You think that's a reasonable conclusion to draw? And walking about 2 feet from him is another guy wearing coveralls, and there's a company logo, and he's got a tool belt on, and he's dragging a canister or a can or a bucket or something. And he's got a walkie-talkie. And I would assume that in all likelihood he has something to do with maintenance. You think that's a reasonable assumption? Absolutely. And you see people walking around, and they've got these athletic attire on, and there's a high likelihood that maybe they've come from a workout place, or maybe they're getting ready to go jog. Aren't those reasonable assumptions that we make every day? It's because we understand the principle that your clothing says something about you. Now, sometimes it says nothing more than you have awful taste, but, you know, that's all right, too. But your clothing says something about you, and the Bible acknowledges that. For example, over in the book of Proverbs, there's a statement. Proverbs 7 is a warning from a father to a son about the company that he keeps, and particularly about the female company that he keeps. Proverbs 7 is a warning against hanging out with immoral women. And in Proverbs chapter 7, he describes this young man who's gone out in the middle of the night, and this young man is looking for trouble. And he finds it in verse 10. He says, "Behold, a woman comes to meet him dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart." In other words, you could tell something about her just by the way she was dressed, right? And my guess is many of us have probably seen some prostitutes before. Lurking on street corners. It's not that we necessarily go looking for them, but you see them sometimes. You can tell by the way they're dressed there's a problem with their morals. You can say that in the opposite. opposite sense, though. Turn over to the book of Psalm number 45. Psalm 45 is actually a royal psalm. It's a celebration of the marriage of the king's son. I don't know exactly who the king was. It's called a Maskil of the Sons of Korah, so I don't know that it was necessarily one of David's sons. But a king is getting married. The prince is getting married. And there's a statement made about his bride over in Psalm 45 in verse 13. The king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is interwoven with gold. She will be led to the king in embroidered work. The virgins, her companions who follow her, will be brought to you. Been talking a lot about weddings lately. The only one getting married. Well, we probably do. But here is a bride. You know how you can tell she's the bride? By what she's wearing. Have you ever noticed that at weddings, they don't wear t-shirts that say, I'm the bride? They don't have that. You can tell with a single glance who is the most glorious person in the room. And it's always the bride. It's never the groom. If it's the groom, you got problems. But you can tell something about their identity simply by the way that they dress. Clothing reflects character. Now, the text I want us to look at for a few moments, and this is a very familiar text. Usually when we talk about modesty and modest apparel, this is where we turn to every time. 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. There's a lot of things in this chapter I'm not sure about. There's a few things I'm fairly convinced about. But toward the end of the chapter, Paul has been talking in the first about 8 or 9 verses. I'm in 2 Timothy. It would help if I was in the right place. In the first 8 verses, he is talking specifically about men and some of their responsibilities, particularly about prayers that they lead. I think 1 Timothy 2, in my opinion, is talking about public worship. Now, he doesn't describe it in a way that we might expect, but I think he's talking about roles that each gender had, because the first 8 verses are talking specifically about men. And he tells them that in a particular context, men are supposed to pray, and in that same context, women are supposed to be quiet. That would describe a worship service. Although, again, I couldn't necessarily prove that, but it seems to make a great deal of sense. But in that context, in verse 9, he says, likewise. Now, he's been talking about men up through verse 8. In verse 9, now he's going to talk about the women and their place while this other is going on. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. I think that that context is suitable to a worship setting as well, where the women were not permitted to teach over men. But again, 2 times he emphasizes their place is simply to be quiet and to receive instruction. In other settings, that would not apply, but certainly in this setting, that's exactly what he wanted from them. Now he says, one of the things that they have as a responsibility is in their clothing. I want women, he says, to adorn themselves with proper clothing. The word proper there means well-ordered or decent or well-arranged. And then he says, I want them to dress modestly and discreetly. The King James says to dress with shamefacedness and sobriety. The word modest there, or shamefacedness in the King James, is iodos, and it means a sense of shame, a sense of modesty that is fast and rooted in one's character. The American Standard Version translated it as shamefastness. Aristotle said this is basically the ability to know when to get embarrassed about something. Now, a lot of times what we preachers do, what I've heard a lot of Christians do, is say, well, that's talking about nakedness. When you're naked, you ought to be embarrassed. And that's a truthful statement. But it applies to a lot of settings. There are many situations where we ought to be embarrassed, and we're sometimes not. In this particular context, he is not talking about women who were wearing too little. He was talking about women who were wearing too much. They came to worship in a gaudy way, in a look-at-me sort of way. And he says, that should have brought shame, but it didn't. He goes on to say that they are to dress modestly and discreetly. The word discreet means using good judgment, soundness of mind, sound judgment. Trench referred to it as an inner quality of self-discipline. You constantly keep a rein on the passions. And so here's a woman who exercises restraint in her appearance. And he says, instead of using braided hair and gold and pearls and costly garments, rather they should be decked out with what? By means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Their clothing reflects their character. One other passage along this line, and we don't often look at this, but it says almost the same thing. Over in 1 Peter chapter 3, Now, I don't think he's talking here about worship. He's simply talking about wives and their relationships to their husbands. And I think in this particular context, he's talking about wives who were married to unbelievers. What was the best thing they could do to try to convert their husbands? He says, well, there comes a point when talking to them probably isn't going to work anymore. They may have just made up their mind that they don't buy the argument. So what's the best thing you can do? He says, you live a godly life. And you reflect that in all facets of your life. He says in verse 1 of 1 Peter 3, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. And one of the ways that you could see that was how? Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. Very similar language to 1 Timothy chapter 2. He's saying, you impress him with your character. And one of the ways in which that is seen is in the way that she dresses. So the first principle, and I think far and away the most important biblical idea about how you dress, is that your clothing says something about your character. Now, in the context of 1 Timothy 2, you can overdress. It's interesting to me, there are quite a few statements in the Bible about this particular condition. We saw back here in 1 Timothy chapter 2. I want you to do an exercise in context. Put yourself back in the church in Ephesus when Timothy was the preacher there. As you sit here and sit in the audience on Sunday, and Timothy just got this letter in the mail and he's reading it to the congregation, and he says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly. And when he gets to this part, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Who do you think would have heard that as a way of saying, you know what, I need to rethink my dress? You think it would have been slaves? You think it would have been the poorer women in the congregation? No, they would not have had the means to buy gold and pearls and go down and have their hair done in a very elaborate way. He was most likely talking to the wealthier women in the congregation. And he's saying, you know what, you need to not dress in such a way as to be gaudy and draw attention to yourself. You know what? When we come to worship, we're not here to worship Ralph Lauren. We're here to worship the living God. And sometimes clothing can stand in the way of that. I'm all for dressing up in worship. But sometimes I think we overdo it. Let me show you another passage where this was exactly the same kind of problem. Over in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 3. The opening chapters of Isaiah, like most of the prophets in the Old Testament, the opening chapters is usually caught up with denunciations for the nation's sins, and that's exactly what you have in Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3, down in verse 16, moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. In that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets and headbands and crescent ornaments, dangling earrings and bracelets and veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings. festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. And can you imagine the purse that all that fit in? He was talking about women who were dressed to the nines. They were so dressed up, you could probably hear them with all the stuff they were carrying. You saw them coming two blocks away, and he says, I've had enough of that. They were gaudy, they were ostentatious, they were showy, they were saying, look at me. And the Lord said, I've had enough of that. So, it's possible, when you talk about modesty, that it can become a hindrance by putting too much reliance on clothes, by putting too much emphasis on what you wear, by putting so much emphasis on your outward appearance that you forget about the first principle. You forget about your character. Now, it's possible to go in the other direction. Now, usually when you preach about modesty and modest apparel, you have to pay your respects to the people who don't wear enough clothing, and there are plenty of those. Now, as I said, you look at 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 3, and some other texts, they're not dealing primarily with that. I think they deal incidentally with that. Remember, Paul said they should be dressed with shamefacedness and sobriety. The Bible teaches that nakedness, and that's kind of an elastic word, but nakedness is a shameful thing. Back in Genesis chapter 2, after God created Adam and Eve, they were together in the garden. And it says, what's the last verse of Genesis chapter 2? It says, they were naked and they were not ashamed. It was perfectly natural for them as husband and wife to be in their presence and not experience shame about that. Now, what's interesting is you get to the very next chapter after they sin. You go back to Genesis chapter 3, right after they sin. Remember, they would hear the sound of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Before their sin, they were perfectly fine with that. They looked forward to those moments of fellowship with God. It was a perfectly natural thing. But, verse 9 of Genesis 3, the Lord called the man and said, where are you? And he said, well, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. So I hid myself. You know what he's experiencing? He's experiencing shame. For the first time ever, he experienced the concept of shame, and it was connected with his nakedness. And God said, who told you that you were naked? Have you done what I forbid you to do? And there are other passages. Now, a lot of other passages, when they talk about nakedness, are usually using the idea metaphorically, but metaphors work only if there's a reality associated with it. For example, in Revelation chapter 3, in the letter to the church in Laodicea, he says in verse 17, because you say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing, you do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I advise you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may become rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself, and that the shame of your nakedness will not be revealed. And I say, I have to anoint your eyes so that you may see. He's talking here about their spiritual condition, so he's speaking, I think, metaphorically. But nonetheless, that reality is there. When people are without proper clothing, there should be a sense of shame about that. Now, you've got to be careful about that. As I said, in the Bible, a lot of these passages are speaking of it metaphorically, and you need to avoid pressing those passages too far. And sometimes the word nakedness is not talking about lack of clothing. It's talking about destitution. Nakedness is a metaphor for that. For example, in Job chapter 1, after Job lost all of his property, he lost all of his family. You remember what he said? Naked I came forth from my mother's womb. If you just left it there, you might think, okay, he came out without any clothes. Most babies do. But then he says, and naked shall I return. People aren't buried naked. He's talking about destitution. I came into this world with nothing, and I shall leave with nothing. And it fits the context because in chapter 1, he just lost everything. Nakedness is a metaphor for destitution. Back in the book of Revelation, you see exactly the same kind of thing. Revelation chapter 17, when God judges the great harlot, when he judges the Roman Empire and her false religion, Revelation 17, in verse 16, it says, "And the ten horns which you saw in the beast, these will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire." Now you might think, okay, it's going to take away all her clothes. Actually, it's just saying he would reduce her to nothing. Remember, she was a prostitute. She was probably already naked. What is this nakedness? He's talking about destitution, bringing her to nothing, taking away everything that was valuable to her. So when the Bible talks about nakedness, you have to be a little bit cautious about the context, but nonetheless, it's something that the Bible repeatedly talks about in a shameful sort of way. Another principle that we need to remember is that you should not tempt others. And this has some relevance to the issue that we just talked about. If I know that my clothing is going to cause someone else to lust, or if I know that my clothing is going to cause someone else to stumble in some way, maybe my clothing will cause someone else to be envious. If that's the case, I need to take that into consideration. Over in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 14, Romans chapter 14, verse 13, "Therefore let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way." Verse 21, "It is good not to eat meat or drink wine or to do anything by which your brother stumbles." It is good not to eat meat or drink wine or wear clothes that offend your brother or sister. So I must determine never ever to put a temptation in front of a fellow Christian. Now, in the context of modesty, I want to make a side point here. This last point, I've heard a lot of discussion about modesty. I know in the past when I have preached about it, I've probably made this same point, and I'd like to think I'm getting a little bit smarter about it, maybe not. But I know a lot of times the emphasis is put on the role of the woman, that you ought to dress modestly so that you don't cause your brother or sister to stumble, and that is true. But you know what the main reason is why you ought to dress modestly? Because God said so. And sometimes we men are the problem and not the women. Remember what Job said in Job 31, verse 1? "I made a covenant with my eyes, therefore how can I gaze upon a virgin?" Job said the problem isn't her, the problem's me. Sometimes we use lust as sort of a trump card. "Well, she made me lust." Nobody makes you lust. That's a choice. If it's sin, it's always a choice. And even though the woman may share some guilt in that from time to time, and even though that is a legitimate reason for dressing modestly, you only dress modestly because it's the right thing to do. That's a good enough reason, don't you think? God said so. He gave no other reason than that. But these are four, I think, basic principles about the choices that we make about modesty and modest apparel. Now, I want to talk for the rest of the lesson about some challenges that we face when we start trying to apply this. There are challenges that we face in making good decisions, and these challenges are always there. Number one, the challenge of context. Well, that wasn't the first one on my list. I guess I'll change this. I'm going to start with number two because that's in my notes, and that's what I wanted, and I typed it wrong, and I'm stupid. Culture. I know for a long time I tried to resist the idea that modesty and culture are related, but that was just wrong. Modesty and culture are very much related. Attitudes about clothing change over time. If you live in the same place long enough, you're going to see changes in the way people dress. If you travel a lot, you can travel a lot in 1 week's time and go from this place to this place to this place, and you'll see different attitudes and practices about how people dress. On the one hand, we're told that culture does not set our standards. Romans chapter 12, won't you read a couple of verses with me in Romans 12? Obviously, verse 2, "Do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good, acceptable, and perfect." Obviously, we don't want the world setting our standards, but I want you to look a little bit later in Romans chapter 12, down in verse 17. "Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. In other words, to a point, as long as it doesn't violate your conscience, as long as it doesn't violate the will of God, you try to accommodate culture. And that could include some ideas about dress. I've never done overseas evangelism, but one thing I've thought about many times, if I were to take my family to the Middle East, I would require every woman in my household to wear a veil, like the locals do. Because, not because I'm religiously obliged to, but because I know in their culture that is a huge offense for a woman not to do that. If you're familiar with Arabic culture, one thing you don't do when you travel to the Middle East, you don't shake with your left hand. That is hugely offensive to them. And I would do everything in my power to never offend them on that. It's a minor point to me. I don't care if you shake my hand or not. But I know to them it matters. And that's a case where how you dress can affect how people perceive you. Culture matters when we start making applications about what we do. Another example. Go back to the Old Testament. You ever get in an argument with your kids about jewelry? About jewelry that's acceptable and jewelry that's not acceptable? Well, go back to Genesis 24. This lovely story about Rebecca and being chosen as the bride for Isaac. And I just love this story. And over, remember, Abraham's servant goes all the way back to the land of his forefathers. He wants to pick out a suitable bride for his son Isaac. And he finds Rebecca in the household of Laban and Bethuel. And he has all this bargaining and all this stuff. They finally agree that Rebecca is going to go back to Abraham's household to meet Isaac. And in verse 53, the servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebecca. And he also gave precious things to her brother and her mother. And then also in, let's see. Well, I'm missing something. A little bit earlier. In verse 47, the servant is relating the story. He was asked, whose daughter are you? And she said, the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, and Milcah bore to him. And I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrists. How's that for an engagement testament? I assure you that when I proposed to Alethea, I did not put a ring on her nose. Now, she wanted one, but I wouldn't give her one. But, you know, your kids come home sometimes, and they want to be pierced here, there, and everywhere, and we get shocked at that. Well, folks, back in biblical times, remember that description in Isaiah 3 about the ankle rings and the nose rings and this and that and the other? Different cultures do different things. That might shock and appall us, but culture is very much a part of the modesty question. That first point, which should have been the second one, context. Everything has context. Consider the use of veils in the Bible. While we're in Genesis 24, Rebecca goes with the servant back to Abraham and Isaac's house. Verse 64, Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And he said, "He is my master." Then she took her veil and covered herself. So for her, a veil was a sign of submission and humility. All right, now turn just a few chapters over to Genesis chapter 38. Genesis chapter 38, the story of Judah and Tamar. Genesis chapter 38, down in verse 14, Tamar removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enam, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face with what? With a veil. In this case, it's a veil in the same culture, but it's used in a very different context for a very different meaning. Apparently, by how you wore your veil, or the kind of veil that you wore, it said you're either a humble woman or you're a prostitute. turn over to the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 4. Song of Solomon, chapter 4, in verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Now, this is the husband speaking to his bride on their wedding day. And the veil is sort of like negligee. It's very erotic, but it's in a husband and wife context, so it is perfectly suitable. And then one other reference to coverings, the word veil is used, I don't believe, but over in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, some women tried to wear coverings in some contexts, and Paul said no, because it's a symbol of what? It's a symbol of authority. And under certain contexts, this should be covered. Men, not women, yes. A veil used in very different ways across the spectrum of Scripture. Context has a lot to do with that. And so, you think about how you present yourself to others. My guess is when all of you were little kids, or when you had little kids, did you ever get upset when your kids ran around the house without any clothes on? You probably laughed at it. You know, when little kids are about 2 or 3 and they learn how to walk and they also learn how to undo their diapers, they'll just run through the house and everybody gets a kick out of it. Now, if Nate did that, I'd be horrified. Context means a lot, doesn't it? And sometimes what families do in their homes or in their backyard is probably a little bit different than what we do in public, because context has meaning. Another thing is consideration. Do you remember that rule that I gave you at the beginning? You wear what you are. Your clothing says something about your character. If every time you got ready to buy a garment, or every time you got ready to get dressed, if you ask the question, what does this say about me as a person? Do I want people to perceive me in a certain way? Does my clothing reflect that? If you do that every time, a lot of the issues will probably just evaporate. Give consideration to what you wear. And give consideration to how your clothing affects other people. Whether it's the issue of lust or not, it may just be attitudes that people have. There are a lot of types of clothing. There are a lot of types of jewelry. There are a lot of personal care items that probably aren't sinful, but sometimes they can create an awfully bad taste in people's mouths. And maybe the better thing to do is be thoughtful about it and respect the ideas and opinions of others, rather than, I'm going to dress this way or bust. Well, you may. But does that mean it's a good thing to do? We need to show consideration in the way we dress. We need to be consistent in the way that we dress from place to place and time to time, and that's not easy, is it? Not at all. And sometimes we dress in a certain way in a certain context, and we're just not even thinking that, well, it might affect this person, and it does, and we find out about it, and everybody's heard, and all that stuff. It happens. But you strive for a little bit of consistency. Now, one of the things that some people do is they develop dress codes as a way of handling consistency. You see this a lot in workplaces. You see it a lot in school. If your kids go to school in Jefferson County, they have a dress code in most of the schools. And that's just to develop a concept of consistency. Does it always work? No, that's the problem with rules. You try to anticipate problems with rules, but you can't anticipate everything. And inevitably, somebody's going to come in wearing something and you're not sure if it fits the rules or not. That's the problem with the dress code. Modesty is a lot more than a dress code. It's a lot more than a dress code. And simply deciding that, well, if you wear your hemline to here, and if you don't wear this style and you do wear this style, you'll always be modest. It doesn't work that way. Some of those rules might help, but they don't solve every issue that you're going to deal with. My middle sister, Dana, has 3 boys, and they were all boy, rough and tumble kids. And when they were growing up, they perceived that most of their friends would wear blue jeans to church, like on the Sunday nights and Wednesday nights, and they went right around this with Dana. And she she just steadfastly held her ground. Until one day, one of them said, "Well, now, wait a minute here, Mom. We can't wear blue jeans, but you wear denim skirts and denim dresses." And they had her. She said, "Okay. So what's the difference with denim breeches? It's a fabric." And she had kind of codified the thing. She'd made a code. Well, we don't wear jeans to church. And when they started questioning, it's like, well, maybe that's not a great rule. So codes can be helpful, but dress codes can also get you into trouble. We try to use them to help us with consistency, but sometimes the rules get in the way of, what was that most important point? The principle that says your clothing reflects your character. So while codes and rules and that kind of thing can be helpful, we're taught by these principles. God is the ruler of all things. He is the ruler of heaven and earth. He is the ruler of my life and your life. And if he's the ruler of my life and your life, that also means he rules your closet, which means he rules your clothes too. He has the right to tell you how you ought to dress. And sometimes we forget that. But now, remember the most important thing. Your dress, your clothing, says something about you. What does your clothing say about you? What does it say about your relationship to God? What does it say about your relationship to others? If that's what you get out of the lesson, then you got exactly what I wanted you to get out of it. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, God rules every part of your life. Whether you choose to submit to him or not, he's still God. He's still King. He just wants you to volunteer for this thing so that he can bless you. For those of us that are Christians, we sometimes want to resist and do our own thing, and that's never appropriate. If there's some correction you need to make in your